New Thinking Aloud is presented by the California Institute for Human Science, a fully accredited university offering distant learning graduate degrees that focus on mind, body, and spirit. The topics that we cover here, we are particularly excited to announce new degrees emphasizing parapsychology and the paranormal. Visit their website at cihs.edu.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hi, I'm Leanne Whitney, guest host, working alongside host Jeffrey Mishlove, co-host Emmy Vadnase, and my other colleagues here at New Thinking Aloud. Today, I am thrilled to welcome C. Michael Smith to the show. Dr. Smith is a clinical psychologist and medical anthropologist who studied at the University of Chicago, the Chicago Theological Seminary, and the C.G. Jung Institute of Chicago. He has lectured in Jungian psychology and shamanism for the Jungian Society of South Italy, taught in the third-year analyst training program of the C.G. Jung Institute of Bangalore, India, and lectured for the Moscow Society of Jungian Analysts and for the Russian Academy of Science. Michael is founder and director of the Crow's Nest Centers for Shamanic Studies in the USA, France, Belgium, and South Africa. Since 2009, he has worked in a circle of 152 shamans from 85 indigenous cultures in a community based in Paris. Michael is author of Jung and Shamanism in Dialogue and Psychotherapy and the Sacred. In this interview, Michael shares his awakening experiences, his turn towards Jungian psychotherapy, and his work with shamanic practices and inner guides. We talk about archetypes, dark and light energies, and the importance of stability and heart-centered living. Michael is joining me today from his home office in Michigan, and now I will switch over to the internet interview. Hi, Michael. Welcome. Thank you for joining me. It's nice to be with you.
Oh, well, thank you, Leon. It's great to be here, too.
Yeah, I'm excited to explore a lot of terrain with you, but I'd like to start, actually. I know you've had a couple awakening experiences, so I don't know if there's a setup to that, but if you could tell us, I believe at 19 and maybe 34, you had two experiences that deeply impacted probably the trajectory of your life. If you could share those with us, I think that will set a great foundation for where we're going to go.
Really, the first big one was when I was about 3 years old, and I'm in my bedroom, and I think I'm in a crib for some reason, or a playpen, I don't know, but I'd been sleeping. I woke up, and I had an experience of just being immortal, no beginning or end, and I thought, this is strange, and where am I here? You know, and my body felt strange. But I had this just a sense of eternity, really, you know, timeless. And it was pure awareness. The second one was at 19, and this was just a visionary experience, rooftop vision. I used to climb out of my bedroom. There was a window I could climb onto the roof. And we lived up against a forest. And on the roof, I could watch the sunsets go down. And one night, I think it was about October, the sun was setting. If it was already down, in fact, it was magenta skies. I loved the colors, you know, that change as the sun goes down on a clear sky. But it was cool that night, and fog was rolling in, you know, coming over the trees, you know. And in the fog, I suddenly had a vision that I was a medical doctor or a professional healer of some sort. And I was working in Africa. And I was surrounded by other healers, like I was doing some type of charity work there, you know, teaching something. And that stayed with me. But 42 years later, when I'm setting up the first legal South African festival of shamans. We invited different tribes and the Kalahari Bushmen the Koshas from Hogsback Mountains and so on, and a lot of local healers. We were on the edge of the Kalahari Desert, but as we were driving to it, I recognized the trees from my vision. These were like tall poles, and they had pom-pom-like leaves on top. And then as we pulled in, the tents were all Arab tents with couches inside and this sort of thing for different teachers and rest places, you know. And I saw the big space I was going to be working in. And I realized all these healers were going to gather around me and listen to me. And wow, it was like jumping a timeline, you know. This is something I'd seen 42 years later. That was in 2012. So that was a kind of an opening too, you know, to realize that there could be some foretelling of the future. It's not something I'd really thought about until that moment. And then around age 47, I was going through a big life change, a divorce, that sort of thing, and was living alone. And I felt good about my life, but I was focused on healing and using my spiritual practices to heal. And so one night I had another spontaneous event of skeletization, which is just a word for a kind of a dismemberment process, you know. And I found myself in an underwater cave and sitting on a ledge, and there was a great big raven there, and she had a lot of little blackbirds around, and they just flew at me and began eating and peeling off my skin, you know, and the fascia, and then the tissues and soft tissues and muscles. And each time this raven mother was transmitting to me, see, you're not this, you're not that, you know. And it stripped me all the way to the bones, popped out my eyes, see, you still are, you know. And then all the bones disappeared, and there was nothing. It was pure emptiness, shunyata. You know, and I was in that state for quite some time. And then I heard clicking of bones in the background. And then all these blackbirds come in and they're whirling around and reassembling a skeleton and reforming a body for me. And I had a colleague at Cambridge University in England. And I was so blown away by this experience, I contacted her. And she herself was a shamanist and medical anthropologist. She said, I would run for cover. I said, what do you mean? She goes, your life is going to change. And boy, it did. Everything that was not right, was not authentic or true in my life, had to go. I was intolerant of anything but who I am and what I'm here to do. So that was a big, powerful one. And around the same time, my 47th year, I also discovered Sri Ramana Maharshi's direct inquiry method. And I began using that to stabilize this state that now for me is really a non-dual, you know, awareness that emptiness is form, form is emptiness. I'm here doing my thing, you know, and I am both big mind and the smaller step-down version of it, doing the work I'm doing. And so here I am.
Thank you for sharing all that. That 3 years old, I mean, that's very young to have that sort of experience. And then obviously you're continuing to have them throughout your lifespan. What was the first turn towards a lineage or a system of thought that helped you begin to maybe ground or contextualize the experiences that you were having? Who was the first teacher you turned towards?
So there's another event that happened at 34 before that put me on the shamanist path at a time. I was friends with Michael Harner, and he was not known. At the time, he was publishing little mimeographs he was sending out to people that were interested, you know. And he was very interested in my work with Jung. But there just nobody even knew what the word was in the public. You know, it's a popular term now, but at the time it wasn't. And I didn't even know what was going on with me at the time. So what happened at 34, and I was still married, is the wife and I used to take walks at night in the summer. And we lived in a street with lots of trees and also street lights. And so there would be light and shadow at night, you know. And every time we did it, I saw this amazing thunderbird with wings spread out, you know, and colors of blue and black and gold. And, you know, its height maybe 40 feet and hovering above the trees and stretching its wings out through the tree branches and everything. And we did this walk many times, but I didn't know it was something unusual. And one night I said to her something about that bird that we always see. And she said, "What are you talking about?" You know, and she didn't have an experience of it. And I was shocked because she's a visionary artist and very good at seeing things. And so I thought, Well, anyway, once I recognized it was unique to me, she didn't share it, I kind of freaked out a bit, you know. And I thought, well, what's going on with me? And I was on my way to work, driving 60 miles an hour, and the road just exploded and opened up, and my car plunged into an abyss, and there were all kinds of beings that were numinous, you know, and colorful and fascinating, and I just wanted to go explore, you know. And then the voice said, "You can't, you're on the road," you know, and I had to pull out of it, you know. So I turned the car around, went back home, and I told my wife, and she said, "Well, if you know, the psychiatrist, they're going to put you on medication. I know you don't want to be on." She said, "Why don't you try union analyst? You were in analysis before." And so I did, and picked this guy, Tom Kapuscinskas. And in the second session with him, he said, "Okay, so this is not so much for analysis, but what you need is a shamanic teacher." So he connected with me, with the guy up in Canada, in the Hudson Bay area. And I went up there for 2 weeks, flew out onto Lake Temagami, and landed, and the pilot said, "See you in 2 weeks." And I did sweat lodges with this guy every day. We did some canoeing. I found really a solo quest site, you know. And I was left there 4 days and four nights right out of a sweat lodge, you know, with no food or water. And so the visions increased under those conditions, but also the clarity. And the clarity was, okay, this is a shamanic calling, and I don't really have a choice here. You know, this is what I'm here for. It's kind of like destiny. And you can think of the guardian spirit as like a daimon, a creative daimon, but it says yes and no to things. And it's like, this is my path. And I said, "How can I do it? Nobody will even know what I'm talking about." And it suggested University of Chicago to me, you know, which was a school I was interested in because Mircea Eliade was there and other figures that I like, Robert Moore, Paul Ricoeur.
I'm sorry, what year are we, Michael? What year is this?
It's 84.
1984, okay.
Mm-hmm. So that was thing that took me into medical anthropology and psychology and the Jung Institute and that sort of thing. So in those years, I was looking for a frame. Once I was done, I joined a Potawatomi community here and worked with the tribal president, Tom Topash. And he taught me a lot of ceremonies and this sort of thing. And then I had a Cherokee teacher, we'll call Eileen. And she taught me very powerful shamanic healing methods. And then from there, I'm off to South America. You know, I was for an 8-year apprenticeship with the Kiswa Taita Yatsak Don Alberto Taxo, and also from there into the plant medicines for another 5 years in the jungles of Iquitos around that area, Tarapoto. And so these had big impacts. And also, one thing led to another. And for the past 16 years, I've been part of the Cercle des Sages in Paris, which is a bunch of shamans from 85 different indigenous cultures. And so we do ceremonies together for a week, and we learn from each other. It's an exchange of knowledge, you know. And then we invite the public to come in for public ceremonies. So it kind of unfolded like that.
Mm-hmm. Wow, there's so much there in what you shared. Thank you so much for that broad overview and a blessing, I think, to be guided into the Jungian tradition when one is in the West and going through that kind of awakening, because there's the space, the presence, the archetypal considerations, whether we want to call it infrastructure. You did use a word, stability, I believe, or stabilized.
Stabilized.
Yeah. And I think that's a really important word, certainly for awakening experiences. But could we say also, just as healers, psychologists, sort of in life overall, that when we're perhaps born into families or cultures where the secure attachment isn't happening, like the stability, the psyche is floundering right from the get-go. Do you see any kinds of similarities there between the original grounding when we're really young and also the stabilization that needs to have once the big awakening experience has happened?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything you said.
Yeah. Because when we're young, like when you said, like at three years old, I mean, we're in this developmental process where hopefully our parents have our mind in mind, so to speak, so they're able to stabilize our energy field and bring us into the body. Well, what about that archetypal aspect of Jungian psychology and how it dialogues with shamanism, or perhaps here bringing in the work of Henri Corbin, the Mundus Imaginalis? Is there anything to share as far as that dialogue, that bridge?
Sure. We've spent a lot of time on that, but I'll try to be concise. So, I wrote two books to create a platform for myself because there was no framework to do what I was going to do within this cultural context, you know, in the early 1980s. So, I read the collected works of Jung. I looked very carefully, you know, and turned him into like a modern dialogue figure with kind of the archetype of shamanism, you know, and trying to tease out of Jung the shamanistic elements. And I found quite a few. He ended up with alchemy a lot. But really, for me, the key is in those Red Book years, it was even before the Red Book came out, he makes references to it in his biography, Memories, Dreams, Reflections, autobiography. So there, I can see that he was having direct experience with an inner guide. And he called it an inner guru, and it took various forms and stabilized finally as Philemon, right? So Jung has different words for the archetypal, and they changed all the time. But he had nodal points, primordial images, you know, and eventually archetypes. And it's the primordial image, which is a living image. It's a being, an entity, you know. So it's not reducible to my own subjectivity. Jung's trying to translate into his own crafted modern psychology. So he talks about the collective unconscious, you know, kind of list there. But other places, he says there's another name for that. There's a comment to somebody about William James' belief that the unconscious was the spirit world, and he says, actually, that's the better term for it. So even there, he's acknowledging something objective of the independent individual headspace or psyche. So it's easy to make a link with Corbin, okay, who is he's a theologian, phenomenologist, steeped in the Sufi traditions of 12th century Iran. And Ibn Arabi, that guy was amazing. he kind of mapped out this cosmos that has a lot in common with shamanism and a lot in common with Jung's experiences. And it's the Alam al-Mita, or the Mundus Imaginalis, you know, is how it's translated by Corbin. And the main thing that struck me is that we each have an angel. What's the angel of your own being? Which is the same as a daimonion or a guardian spirit. And this being is a specific revelation, particular to you, or the individual to whom it's being experienced. That is the guide for your life, the source of inspiration and guidance, you know, and your destiny. So the crux of Corbin's books is really the importance of seeing that this angel or daimon is your immediate connection with the divine. It's a stepped down version of the ground of being itself, you know, which is formless, you know, but there's something, some prehensive sentient intelligence that allows spontaneous images or revelations to form. And these are real. And of course, I live by that. I work by that. It's my morning practice. It's my evening practice. It's what does the work that I do, you know. So the step me, I'm a step down version of that, you know, and the vehicle for it to do its work in the world.
And when you use the term objective, are we talking about pure consciousness, the contents of consciousness, like something that can be seen? I love stepped down. So I know you had an experience of Satchitananda, or the pure awakening, like the pure awareness, let's say. So we have pure awareness, and then we have the contents of that awareness. And so it's interesting, the subject-object dialogue. Because in one sense, it is you from the big subject sense or the cosmic sense. I don't know if there's any clarity.
I know exactly what you're saying. Yeah. So anything that's a content is an object. And who's perceiving that? Who's witnessing that, you know? So that's the big mind, you know, that has no form whatsoever. It's just pure self-aware energy. You know, and it has agency too. I mean, it incarnates, you know, and it can guide your life, you know, and it can spontaneously form itself into an angel or a guardian spirit. It's quite amazing, this dance between formlessness and form and what goes on. But even the self that I know, that's an object, because who knows it? Who's witnessing it, you know? So, and it's a step down version of this higher, deeper, wider consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Again, stepped down. I appreciate that turn of phrase. The heart is coming up for me in this. So if it does have agency, and we know that intention is part of a shamanic path and also part of good mental health. What is it that we're intending? I'm a big fan of morning practices, or setting up the day really clearly, the first 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes. Maybe you could explore that a little bit, like this power of seeing, or the power of pure awareness, intention, the heart, or the blockage to the heart. Are we talking about angels and demons there, or what's coming up for you as I share that?
Well, there's a lot there, you know, what you're saying and implying. Yeah, so for me, the center, capital C, you know, that's the spiritual center. It's Satchitananda. That's the deepest depth, you know, and a step-down version of that is the daimon or guardian spirit. The step down version of that is my pure aware I. Jung used the Freudian term ego. Actually, Freud didn't use it either. It's das Ich. This is the I. James Strachey translated that as ego because he thought it would be more scientific sounding in Latin, you know. So that ego brings in other things like attachments, clinginess, narcissism. And Jung did not mean that by the ego. That's, you have to have complexes that are like attached to it, you know. So to have a pure aware I, according to Jung, this alchemical works, you have to separate from those complexes, you know, so that you have this pure aware I. And he says, when you have that, it's not other than the self. And of course, he's making his reference to Atman Brahman with that. But he's saying that the I is a projection of the infinite into space and time. So it is the center. That's a step down version of the great center. You know, that's the place to live from. And it has agency. And relationship to others is very, very important so that you don't get inflated. If you're blended or merged or mixed or united, it's very easy to get taken over and you'd be unconscious of that, you know. So he emphasized relationship like an active imagination where you have a dialogue with a conversation. Same thing in shamanism. So with pure awareness, then you can go in and look at the different complexes or parts that are operating in you, those that are wounded or traumatized, those that maybe are not complexes, but they're collective shadow material that's dark or evil. That's there, you know. And Jung encouraged us to look at that, study it closely. And you don't have to let it take you over. You can say, yes, that's there in me too. And I choose not to act on that. So I'm going to keep it out of social circulation. But by golly, I'm going to paint it. So I'm going to put it in poetry. You know, I'm going to talk about it, you know, with people and so on. So the idea was that you could express it that way without doing harm. And by staying conscious, like it's hard to have good without evil. They're, you know, polar opposites. So for Jung, the middle way is, you know, be right in the center, you know, not choosing either good nor bad, but being aware of them and choosing consciously your path and relating to any content consciously. So when it comes to your complexes or parts that are wounded, then you need that aware eye because it can be not only a source of vision and will and action, but also a source of healing and caring and guiding of your different parts back to health and discharging swollen complexes that are filled with pain, shame, and so on. So to do the kind of work that I do is a lot of it's teaching people self-healing, and my workshops around the world are all about that. And I use a shamanic journey for that to create a safe space, which is kind of a mundus imaginalis that we create together. So that we have a structured, organized inner world for people once they've learned the method to begin working with their parts from this pure aware eye. And it's compassionate, it's intuitive, it's creative, it's present. And so the relationship with the part is crucial to the self-healing. And if you don't have that, you get temporary healing, temporary removal of symptoms. And I think it was quite different in the distant past with shamanism, like from 10,000 years back and beyond before agriculture. It's a different system altogether, but it worked in those under those conditions where people lived in communities and they were foragers and they had to bond together. So there was no place for egocentric behavior. That got slapped down. We know that from indigenous cultures where it's just not tolerated. You know, the those early cultures were giver cultures, not taker cultures. You know? And so in that sense, they didn't have the kind of evil and dark forces and energy running rampant that we have today. But today in the modern world, we've got to learn self-healing because that's the only thing that will stabilize ourselves.
Yes, that we have today. And I don't know if it's Central American, South American, what shamanic tradition or tradition overall, this idea of, I believe it's called Wetiko, or the like the mind virus, actually, that the Euro-American culture is currently struggling to heal, which has to do with materialism and taker culture. And I believe in other traditions, it's actually named that. Yes, kind of
Wendigo in Canada. Yeah, it has different names, but yeah. And mind virus is kind of a popular current way to frame it. But that's, yeah, dominated by the taker culture. Because in the past, we know this through indigenous peoples, there was a giving back. You wouldn't take all the berries off of a bush. You would leave some for other animals and this sort of thing. This greed comes in with civilization, basically. And the emperors, conquerors that steal your stuff and, you know, want to get powerful and wealthy. And so that's the disease that's infected modern Western civilization and pretty much spreading all over the planet, you know. And those are dark energies from a shamanic standpoint, you know. I think from Jungian standpoint, there's shadow foolishness, you know.
Mm-hmm, sure. Yeah, cultural complexes, mm-hmm. for sure. And to circle back to this idea of the mind-heart connection, is that when you say, like, you meet with these groups and you set up a structure and we talk about intention, is that one of the aims, like, either along the path somewhere? But if the mind isn't connected to the heart, you know, does that guide humanity in one direction? If the mind is connected to the heart, are we guided in a different direction? If the mind-heart connection isn't there?
Yeah, I like this. So it's important. So the tradition that I really operate out of is Andean, and passed on by the Yacek Don Alberto to me, and I've lived it for a long time now. It's in 25, 26 years. And this path, what I took from it is the South American prophecy of the Pachacuti, the eagle and the condor are symbolic birds that fly together. The condor represents the heart and its capacity to feel and to know. And the eagle represents the intellect, the mind, as we can conceive it that way, which can plan, calculate, analyze, and so on. And it's practical functions, you know. And you need both. So they got to fly together. But to be in balance, though, heart must be led under the leading of the condor. That is, the heart must lead the life. And the intellect then is its ally in arranging things on a practical level and social level that need to happen. And so they can be in balance that way. If the eagle takes the lead like it does in our culture, then we get what we've got, you know, a heavily materialistic, rationalistic, technologically addicted culture, you know. So it's out of balance. And so this is the basic premise out of which I work, is flying with the condor. In my healing work, always the eagle is there, the scholar in me, the analyst in me, and so on. But I don't use them much when I'm doing my own healing work. Because it's my guardian spirit, and it's just following that, and no plan, no treatment plan, just being in the moment and seeing what's going to happen in that moment, being part of that. And it works very well. It's very creative. And so I begin with people with ceremonies, just teaching in the way of the condor, my workshops. So we do fire ceremony, for example. A recent one I did in France, I just put a little simple candle on the floor and some mala beads around it, you know, and showed them how I practice and to connect with my heart, from my heart, with every being that I meet and every time and place. And a little chant, I'd like to sing it if that's okay.
Sure.
Tukui shunkuan kuyani mi. Tukui shunkuan kuyani mi. And so it goes. And you can put the name of your guardian spirit in there in the middle of that and sing it. But in Kichwa, Tukui is a kind of a happening, a greeting in the moment with your whole heart. And it's from your essence to the essence of whatever being, be it a plant, flower, animal, another human, or your parts within. The principle of Tukui means you show up with respect, you know, and compassion, and this kind of greeting that's wishing every being well. And you practice that in every time and place. Yeah. And I share with my students that, you know, I spend 4 to 6 hours every morning at my altar. And so it's not all just contemplative, you know, because I have many projects going on. I bring those into the discussion with my guardian spirit, you know, and how I might do that there and when, how I might even structure it and bring the eagle in, you know. But then I have lunch, and then I see my clients and people I mentor. But I stay, I'm in the condor state, okay? So it doesn't leave, you know. And I greet it at night before I go to sleep, you know. And I wake up in the morning, the first thing I do is go to my altar, light the candles, sing my chant. So I got this ongoing practice. Don Alberto said, every time with feeling you greet a being in any time or place, you know, you're doing ceremony. And there's the ceremony of eating, the ceremony of breathing. There's simple ceremonies, you know. Ceremony of the elements, you know, fire or water or wind, and you connect with them in the spirit of Tukui, or if you're working on your own parts, it's the same way. Each of those things are a ceremony. So he admonished us to live our lives as if every moment was a ceremony. Now, that's some type of non-dual shamanism there.
Non-duality is definitely coming up for me, as well as integrative. It's, you know, to integrate, to be made whole. And that's not an enmeshment whole. It's a very sort of discernment, differentiation, so we can see the beauty of the parts. And in your explanation there, that's very clearly what I'm hearing is nuanced, fine refinement of discernment or differentiation, but yet under the auspices of the integrated whole. So everything sings or is relational, like, it is relational. So by knowing being present through the heart, you are singing in the way of clarity. You know, in the yogic tradition, Anahata is the name for the heart chakra. And that translates as the sound that is made when two things are not struck. And again, that's what I'm hearing in everything that you're describing about your daily practices, as well as these communities that you gather with. They're differentiated, but they're singing together in a beautiful kind of chorus.
So I aspire to teach practice, and then we will reflect with the eagle on it afterwards. So people are very hungry for ideas. And you know, from the New Age phenomena all over the internet and social media, there's all these self-realized people or people that talk the big talk and everything. And kind of banalizing the whole spirituality thing. And it's very easy for the mind to do that. The mind is like a dog that just wants to chew on a bone and it won't stop. I mean, it's just constantly hungry for ideas, you know. So that's not really practice. That's getting lost in the mind, you know. And so we start with practice. We start with the spirituality of it. You know, and I have a little mandala of life. It's like a medicine wheel. And in the north, you have spirituality is something you practice. And in the south, you have materiality, which is rooting yourself in the body and the material tasks and the material world. And you have in the West this interior space where you can work on your parts, do your shadow work and this sort of thing, and ring in the light energy after you dump the dark energy, the hucha, you know, fill it with sami, and clarify your vision. And you're doing all this from center, though, so that when you've moved around this mandala, you take the results of that into the world, to the east, you know, and express that in the world, or spread your seeds around in the world.
Mm-hmm. Again, the word integration, to be made whole, you can't fake it. So you can't co-opt it intellectually. And I think that's what you're pointing to. Like when people are seeking and they're, you know, wanting to absorb, that's great. We don't want to say that's not. But the process of having the practices and dropping it into the body is where the wholeness is manifest. That the mind, the genius, the intelligence of this lived experience is such that the mind cannot co-opt it. The body must also participate through its rituals or through the heart opening.
Right. Right. So, and that, when I've done workshops, that always takes time and repeated practice for so that people get it, because the mind wants to co-opt it all the time.
Yes. But again, the genius I have found in walking this path also for quite a number of years is, wow, you ultimately you can't play a game on this thing. You're only hurting yourself in the end. Like you're only robbing yourself of the experience of the power of seeing, could we say, or I don't know even if we want to put words on it, but certainly I would say the yumminess of the experience from the heart.
Yeah, I think if you're not coming from the deep heart center, then you're not really progressing much. You know, you might be adding stuff, ideas, degrees, this sort of thing, status, I don't know, but you're not really advancing on the path.
Yes, yes. Well, again, can we rewind just a little bit to when you were talking about the plant medicine experiences, and I think you said Iquitos, so I'm assuming that was at least ayahuasca for a portion of it or more. I don't know if you have experience with psilocybin. Like what do you have to share around medicines, plant medicines, as they become more popular and now are back in Euro-American culture, at least in the research labs? Do you recommend them? Do you work with them at all in your communities?
Yeah, first, yes, I've worked a lot with psychedelics and entheogens. For me, it's a sacred medicine, so it has to be done in ceremony. There's always a spirit that comes attached with that medicine, you know, that should be recognized and open to, and a relationship with it established. So that's important. And ayahuasca is probably the most complicated of the ones and is powerful. And I both was one drinking it for myself, then at some point I started working with the curandera and bringing people from Europe and the U.S. and doing workshops. So I began to sing ik arrows with her, and without even trying, you know. In fact, her name is Adelita Navas, and she's old. She's in her mid-90s now, and she was in her early to mid-80s when I was working with her. And if she got tired and wanted you to sit, I would just spontaneously get up and begin carrying on the Icaros that I didn't even know. So that was amazing, you know. And I knew it was telepathic. When she was ready to take over, I just paused, and then she went on. Because of her age, she would get tired at times, so I found that very interesting. And then there were medicines I took in running ayahuasca ceremonies, I can't think of the one now. It's a nut, but you crack it and put it in alcohol and they drink it and it makes it, it's just telepathic. So you can track everybody without the risk of the shaman doing the ayahuasca when they're running ceremony is they can go down into their own stuff and they're supposed to be holding space and channeling these frequencies, these Icaros. And you know, I've seen it happen. It does happen. So this other medicine just allows you to track and follow everything, and you can keep Icarating as you're doing that. I found that very interesting, that I can just walk around the room and feel what was going on with any person in there. You know? Interesting stuff. But there's a downside to ayahuasca. It's an unstable medicine, at least for modern westernized people. And there's a big market for the gringos coming from all over. So people that are less spiritually developed are running ceremonies. And, you know, it's not hard to find a shaman anywhere in the Quetzal Soteropoda. Anybody says, sure, I'm a shaman. Yeah, what do you want? You know, because they want to make money. So I see that as a downside, you know, for ayahuasca tourism. But it's mostly what I see going on in Europe and here, where sometimes shamans go to Europe and sometimes other people are just getting the stuff from places like Iquitos and running their own ceremonies. But the pattern I see is once these medicines are exported out of the jungle, then I see problems that are serious, where people come to the ceremonies, you know, and they pay whatever they pay for it. And 3 or 4 hours later, the ceremonial leader is done and says, bye-bye. You know, people are still deep in and are having some bad experiences. And then they end up coming to see me because I do spiritual emergency work, you know, and they're in terrible state, you know. And not to mention other kinds of abuse that go on, financial, sexual abuse, and so on. So it's with the ayahuasca tourism and the fad of doing ayahuasca that I see the dangers. Because if you're working with a Shipibo shaman, he's usually got a woman he's working with too. It's pretty straight up stuff. It's pretty good, you know?
Yes. I have sat in some of those very same circles where the shaman's done after 4 hours, 6 hours. And yeah, people are getting in their car at 4 a.m. and it's just, whoa, what is happening here? So back to the stability piece. Ayahuasca, maybe not for the masses in Euro-American culture. Yeah, I just know from my own research, my own work with clients, right? 50% of the population in Euro-American culture has insecure attachment. So there's a basic destabilization that's happening at the core of very many psyches. And I don't know if there's something to say about even just starting there. Like without some kind of real relational human-to-human stability, and then you put the medicine on top of it, that infrastructure that you're talking about or the structure, it doesn't have anywhere to ground into because the relational piece hasn't yet been sat in, so to speak. I mean, that's just one sort of warning sign, maybe we could say, to make it a little bit more specific.
One thing I've learned as a medical anthropologist looking at healing systems across cultures is that indigenous cultures and traditional societies, healing is more a public event. So it's done out in the streets or out in the temple that the public has access to, and they come and they watch, and a lot of them are friends and family and other people that are seeking healing, but it's all out in the open. And there's communal support. And it's the same way with ayahuasca among the Shipibo. You know, it's a tribal thing. Everybody gets together, you know, and it helps bond the people together. So the community is a big part of the healing context. And that's what we're missing in modern Western civilization. Again, it goes back to the development of agriculture and the rising of civilization and losing the intimate connections. with family, with the wider community, with the tribe. So we're isolated. We're on our own, you know, fighting to eke out some money or success or something alone and competing with one another and this sort of thing. So that's the general cultural situation we're in. And out of that, there's a lot of dark energies, a lot of pain, people acting out of pain, people passing on ancestral burdens, you know, and then the dead, you know, the spirits of the dead that seem to infect some people. That's a topic we haven't broached yet.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I want to go there just to maybe just put another sort of cherry on top of what you're describing there. It's the social capital. We're lacking social capital. Like, our social groups have greatly diminished over the century, couple centuries. And if we could, yeah, just by this conversation, perhaps keep bringing that into the foreground, so we can really see that without the communal aspects, the human animal becomes, we are mammals. We have a mammal limbic system. Much of us is that, we are a mammal. And so without those communal situations, the mammal becomes sick.
Indeed. Indeed.
Yes. Let us go to the dead. I'm very interested in hearing at the point in your life where I believe maybe you were visited by the dead. Any other beings that you care to share of your experiences with?
Yeah. So, you know, my history was one of a spontaneous election or calling, and a lot of people don't have that, but you can still be a shamanist, follow the path and have your own guardian spirit, so you can learn to do this stuff too. But for me, stuff just kept happening to me. And so I have this situation where if I get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, my room is just filled with people, you know. And I've got a little portal on the ceiling and is inviting them to move on. I consider them, in most cases, the dead that are kind of lost, but recent dead. They're not trapped or something, but they've gravitated towards me wanting some help. But it's really quite strange, because these are 3D holographic living color presences in the room, you know. And for some odd reason, they're dressed in clothes as if they were in physical reality, you know. Maybe that's arranged for my benefit, I don't know. But that's part of the world I live in. I don't take it too seriously until it comes into my clinic, into for healing, okay. And there I see some very interesting phenomena. And I learned exorcism in the jungle with Adelita. And I started doing it because always in Europe, people were tracking me down for it, and I didn't really do it. And then after Adelita, I thought, you know, I can do this. But, you know, it's more of a muscular conflictual thing, you know. And then Robert Falconer and Richard Schwartz, you know, all of IFS is from start to finish is based on shamanism. Schwartz went public with this a few weeks ago with the video, you know, because his guides told him to do it. The whole thing is shamanism, secularized, you know, so it can have a wider power and appeal. But his sparring partner in this territory is Robert Falconer.
And, yes, he's been a guest on our show, actually.
Oh, great. Okay, so you know what he's about. So he talks about UBs, unattached burdens, and I like it. And it's compassion-based, respect-based, and it's much, much easier. And so I've been doing that work. And it shows up in people with heavy trauma. Sometimes it's just a war kind of trauma. Sometimes it's lifetimes of abuse going on in a family line that's handed down. And so you can do all this healing for this person, but there's something keeping them from really stepping into life. And that's where you're likely to have something that's not a part, and it's not a spirit guide. It's not a helpful spirit guide anyway, you know, although some of them claim to be. But it gets attached to the wounded, the most wounded part, usually a young part that doesn't want to be without it because it promised it power or something, you know. But in interviewing these entities, they just usually don't even know where they come from themselves. Sometimes they do, like from a war or something, but often they're confused, and you can let them know that they can't stay, you know, that they're going to have to go. But at the same time, you have to work with the part, and it has to be willing to let it go. So that can take a while before you have that person healthy enough and that part willing to let it go. But I like Falconer's method, and I've been using it, you know, just opening the heavens, you know, and there's light, and you just let the thing go. You can just look up and see hands of light reaching down and just ascend, and they'll help you transmute, you know. So these are like astral energies. A lot of them seem to be dead and displaced. There's other kinds of entities out there, too. I'm not quite sure what they are, you know, but they're not human. They're not parts of a psychological system. They invade. They're like parasites. And there can be some of that going on in Wetiko.
I don't know if you would use the alien entity or, I mean, maybe they don't have to be named, but you're just saying not quite clear. It's not a human related. But do you see intergenerational? Does it seem like there can be a family lineage where an entity is throughout, let's just say, lots of generations in one family system?
I see a lot, yeah. Just passing right down the line. Yeah. And it can even possess several people in the family at once sometimes that are dealing with it, yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. So is there anything else to share about the power then of these entities or the porous mind or once the entity is established, clearly it needs to be released. But how in working with the culture at large, is there any sort of top tips to give around the porousness or the good boundaries or stability? Is there anything to share around that?
Yeah, I do think it's important to have a guardian spirit. That's one of the first things I do with people I'm working with, is help them get that through the heart. I will use a focusing based, I call it the NGS. It's like a somatic sensation of something that feels either positive and interesting to do, or something like a gut response that goes, no, that doesn't seem wise. I'm not called to do that. And cultivate that, because that's really the zone the guardian spirit will speak through. So if I can get that established, that's a big step forward. And then if I can get them to connect with this higher self entity, you know, they've got a lot of power then to move into their stuff.
Yeah.
So once that's there, so the guardian spirit is a protector, you know, and you establish that relationship with it. But also just, I think it's good to do something like smudge down or use a sumerio and smoke the house down, this sort of thing. Or just use your imagination and create a border around your house, your property. I do that all the time, extending it to the forest I live in, you know, so that only Sami can come in, not Hucha, that sort of thing, which is the light energy or the dark energy. For Falconer, he talks about once that entity that Yubi ascends, you close that portal. Jung talks about that too. Jung calls this archetypal possession. And so these would be primordial images, even if they're only affective images. They're primordial images, so they have a holographic quality. They personify spontaneously when you relate to them. And he says you've got to reinstate the repression barrier for archetypal possession. You know, your job is not to integrate them in yourself. They don't belong in you. So any kind of a ritual and image goes with it that kind of locks that out. You know, I see a lot like in the jungle of the Kurin Derizmo shamans going, you know, to lock out negative energy.
Right, right. And just kind of maybe to get into the fine nuances of this, integrate in the sense of acceptance. You don't want to repress it. You want to acknowledge that it's there, but you don't want to bring it into your lived energy bodies. So you have to integrate it in a close sense. But integrative in the worldview model is also important, would we say, like, because it is in the worldview. Otherwise, we repress it out of the worldview, and then you're in trouble because you don't see it for the power that it has.
That's a good point. It's a limitation of Jung's language, you know, but he's working with this unconscious hypothesis, you know, and repression. So that's something that needs not to be in your personal space.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And when you, your awakening experience with the Satchitananda, do you see... from the perspective of Vedanta, it's pure consciousness is really the ontology, that pure seeing. And then there is these deep, powerful energies coming up as the peaceful deities, if you will, or the wrathful deities. I'm blurring traditions a little bit there, but, the Tibetan Buddhism with the Vedanta, but that idea of the peaceful and wrathful deities, but do you see in terms of that pure seeing or pure consciousness, and then the phenomenology from there?
I do. You know, the metaphor of the one that, you know, explodes or emanates the many out of itself, you know, usually there's first is a pair of opposites, you know. So you get this duality, light and dark, male and female, inside, outside, you know, and so on. Good and evil, and all of this is part of big mind, you know, as it's bubbling up. And so why is it there, you know, question. Jung was big, conception of deity, as you know, it's important to acknowledge both, but not necessarily to act out of both, you know, but to be in the center and hold the opposites together in your consciousness and make your choice. And of course, for Jung, it would be a choice based on, you know, your daimonic influence there. So we have a choice. We can look at evil or darkness, but we can say no to it, you know. But it's still divine. You know, it's the divine demonic as opposed to the divine daimonic. But, you know. And it makes life interesting, too. It makes the whole universe interesting, you know.
Yeah, I think the question becomes, could the universe be here if the polarities weren't, just like the Earth? It has a North Pole and a South Pole. I think that's an interesting contemplation. Maybe we wouldn't even be here without the polarities.
Right. In North America, the medicine wheel, one of them, there's usually about 10 medicine wheels, but one of them, north and south, from south to north is the Good Red Road. That's the heart path. And from east to west towards the land of death, that's the Black Road or the Blue Road. And they say that you've got to spend some time on the Black Road so that you know why you need to come back to the Red Road and walk it, you know. So it's like the Black Road is a teacher, you know. And what it's teaching you is the importance of the Red Road. So you wouldn't probably stay on it a stable way if you hadn't had sufficient time on the Black Road to know it. Does that resonate with your question?
So deeply resonating. What's coming to me is like balancing the chakras or knowing the power of the Dantian, or again, the embodied power comes from the discernment, the experiences with the many parts or the many aspects is actually how the power is cooked in the alchemical brew, if we want to go back to another Jungian lineage there. Like you, it's almost like you have to cook it all and be exposed to all of it to carry that kind of power. And I'm mindful of time here. Now, yourself, there are many people out there, and I don't know how many, but doing the work of embodying a clarity, a power, the heart path. Is there anything to share from there? Maybe what you see, or just words of inspiration, especially in this moment in time of where the planet is and its in its wars and its confusions and its insecure attachments. Is there anything to share about the clarity of seeing and the embodied power and any inspiration to give?
Yes, I have no solutions about the state the world is in, other than it's important for each of us to show up in each of those four directions or dimensions, you know, the spiritual, the physical, the inward, and the world, the social. And in the healing work that I do and the healing teaching, you need human relationships to do it too. So I teach self-healing, but that's in the context of relationships. And first of all, with me, but then in dyads, and then in community, and in drone circles, very important. And then beyond that, to have what I call, it's really a Sufi word, sabets, have a partner, a spiritual partner, that pushes you at your edges, you know, that loves and appreciates you and your gifts and can mirror that back, but can also challenge you. And I always have such relationships. And I have one now, a woman, Gabriella. She really pushes me, and it's wonderful. And then my friend Ion, who pushes me in a different way. And there's kind of the difference between the masculine and feminine feels really important to that process. And it's about showing up in all four quadrants.
Mm-hmm. Oh, beautiful. And
the mandala of life.
Yeah, I love that. And deeply relational, deeply, deeply relational. And Michael, I am so thrilled that you said yes to join me for this hour and relate to me in this space.
I was thrilled too. It's delighted. And I read your book. It's like, wow. I definitely got to sit with this moment. Yeah.
Wow. Thank you. And yes, your book, Jungian Shamanism in Dialogue, a classic in the field.
Yeah.
I would say most people who, in young ones coming up, who study Jungian psychology will pick up that book. Anything, any guidance, because I know you wrote it a while ago. There's lots of guidance threaded throughout this whole conversation, of course. But anybody who is just beginning a degree path or the work with Jungian psychology, any final words perhaps for that segment of the population?
Oh, if you're just beginning, just read something simple like his autobiography, Memories, Dreams, Reflections, and then go straight to the Red Book if you're interested. You know, because there you see the richness, the shamanic richness, the daimonic creativity of it all.
Yes. Yeah. And interesting, as you were talking earlier, you know, you sensed, even as you're reading the collected works, you're like, oh, this guy's been through some really deep, profound things before you ever saw the Red Book. I love that. I love that. Well, Michael, again, thank you so much for being with me and sharing this time together and being here with our community.
You're very welcome. And thank you for the opportunity. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you. And thank you for those of you watching and listening. Thank you for being with us. You are the reason that we're here in community, exploring our common unity. You are warmly invited to visit transformationandintegration.com to access additional resources that support the journey through deep transformation and to learn more about the ongoing offerings at Center for Transformation and Integration, including our certified training in transformational coaching with an emphasis in somatic integration therapy. I look forward to welcoming you there.
Book 3 in the new Thinking Aloud Dialogue series is UFOs and UAP, Are We Really Alone? Now available on Amazon.
You can now download a free PDF copy of Issue 7 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine or order a beautiful printed copy.